Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pignucci. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Galef. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today's topic is crowdsourcing, which is using a large group of people, of strangers, often over the internet, to solve some problem or answer some question. And there's a ton of examples of crowdsourcing. People are doing it more and more to design parks or to solve research problems or to create comprehensive encyclopedias online of all of the world's knowledge. And some of the approaches to crowdsourcing work better than others. So we're going to talk today about the relationship between the consensus opinion of a crowd and truth, and what kinds of methods of crowdsourcing are more likely to generate truth and useful answers.
So let me get this straight. Crowdsourcing in general is sort of a kind of a distributed problem-solving approach, or a distributed approach to problem-solving, or whatever it is.
Sure. I suppose we could crowdsource two answers from the two of us and let the best one rise up to the top.
It's a small crowd, but yes. Now, let's. One of the things that I read is that some people tend to think of crowdsourcing as a phenomenon that arose with the internet. In fact, the term crowdsourcing actually is pretty recent. It comes from a Wired magazine article published in 2006.
It's that recent, really?
Yes. Wow. But, so it was coined by Jeff Howey for Wired. But the thing is, in fact, there are historical examples of things that if it were not for the internet, we could be calling crowdsourcing. I mean, the one that I come across in doing the readings for this episode is the Oxford English Dictionary. For instance.
Oh, yeah. Right. Why don't you explain a little bit about how that came to be?
Well, so the OED was actually started by the editors asking for submissions of words, definitions, and word usage. And the whole thing received something like 6 million submissions over a period of 70 years. So,
do you know what kinds of people were... This is one thing that fascinates me about crowdsourcing. Is what motivates people to contribute their time and effort to this big project where they're just an anonymous piece of the puzzle?
Well, that is a good question. So there's some suggestions, let's say. I don't know about research, but suggestions about what the motivations are. And just like in pretty much anything else, I suppose, that human beings do... There can be intrinsic motivations, there can be extrinsic motivations, right? So an intrinsic motivation would be something like, well, I just like doing it because it makes me feel good for whatever reason. Like, for instance, in the case of the Oxford, presumably, or the modern version, which is Wikipedia, somebody might do it. I'm not a contributor to Wikipedia, for instance, but although I think I'm registered.
Either. Yeah, I'm registered, like a freeloader. Actually.
But yeah, so I feel like a freeloader too, but that's okay. Not everybody has to be a contributor in order to use it, as long as you use it properly. But the thing is, so both the Oxford and Wikipedia, I assume that part of the reason people contribute to that without getting any monetary, any financial advantage, without in some cases not even being recognized, officially, they do it because they want to be part of this bigger thing. You know, it's one of the things that Aristotle will say adds meaning to your life. You're part of a project.
Now that you mentioned that, I hadn't made this connection before.
Aristotle or Wikipedia?
Well, no, this feeling of just, deriving meaning or satisfaction from being a part of this thing, even though you're anonymous. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with this phenomenon? I guess it's kind of crowdsourcing. It's like grassroots, spontaneous crowdsourcing of humor. So on Amazon, sometimes, I think spontaneously, there will arise this, trend or this pattern of people writing reviews for some random, like, stupid little object for sale. And the reviews, only tangentially relate to the object. They're really just excuses to do creative writing. So one of the most famous, I think, originators of this trend was Milk, there was like a gallon of milk for sale on Amazon, and people just started writing hilarious reviews, and the reviews got more and more elaborate. There are thousands and thousands of reviews now. If you look for, if you Google Tuscan milk Amazon, and some people wrote long epic poems about milk. Other people like wrote detective stories about milk. Other people just wrote satires. I also contributed. I forget
as
now.
As opposed to a detective story, right? Satires as opposed to,
Yeah, and it just, it became like this massive, like, jam session, essentially, right, between thousands and thousands of strangers on the internet, all with just this one sort of, you know, random theme to anchor it. And it was such fun to be a part of it. Of course, mine was anonymous. Most were anonymous, so no one's going to recognize me for my writing, but it was such fun to be, to participate.
And that actually, I mean, that is an interesting, sort of amusing example, but even Amazon reviews in general often are anonymous, or reviews of websites in general. They're either anonymous or quasi-anonymous. I mean, people use a handle. That you don't, that doesn't necessarily tell you who the actual person is. So,
that's
and,
true,
and
yeah,
yet we use it all the time, right? So obviously the Rationally Speaking blog has a lot of people who comment on it, and most of them are in fact anonymous or quasi-anonymous. And yet they get involved into all sorts of discussions. Sometimes some of the cumulative responses that we get are actually longer than the post that originated the comments.
True. Yeah, no, some of the best discussion.
Yeah, and our posts are not short. I mean, typically a Rationally Speaking post is at least 1,500, sometimes 2,500 words, which is about almost three times an editorial in an op-ed piece in a newspaper. So to get people, sometimes dozens of people, to actually contribute back and forth, and sometimes for weeks, with no reward whatsoever other than the pleasure of having shared their opinion.
I think it's the pleasure of sharing their opinion that seems like an explanation in itself, that people really feel compelled to give their opinion about things.
Right.
And then it's the other kinds of crowdsourcing that it's a little harder for me to explain, where people are doing work. Like doing work to contribute to a large task is sort of less inherently satisfying, I think, than voicing your opinion or judging something or evaluating or rating it.
Right.
So another example of crowdsourcing where people seem genuinely like really motivated to be a part of it is Linux and other open source projects. But
yes,
Linux
is open source projects in general.
Yeah. And there, my cousin actually runs the or ran one of the Debian conferences, which is another open source. I don't even know which noun word to use to describe what Debian is, because I don't know anything about it. But anyway, the people in
we
in,
can crowdsource that.
Yeah, thank you. The people in his community of like Debian developers are sort of ideologically passionate about open source.
Uh-huh.
That things in the world should be open source. The world would be a better place if things were open source. And so that I actually do understand. That's, you know, like a principle that they're working towards.
That's right. So we identified the following motivations. So the intrinsic pleasure of saying that you contributed something, that it's actually a use of your skill, right? So you get to use your skills to do something. Another intrinsic motivation is the pleasure of seeing your, of saying basically what you think about something. I'm thinking not only of comments and blogs and all that, but things like, I use a lot of Yelp, for instance, when it comes out to pick a restaurant where to go. And then I feel like I have to contribute. And so I do contribute, mini reviews.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, part of that is, in fact, so part of my motivation is, like, I suppose, ethical. As in, I use the system, and therefore I am using other people's opinions on these things. So why shouldn't I contribute, since it doesn't take that much time? But the other thing is, yes, there is a sort of a compulsion, at least in certain kinds of personalities, to wanting to give your opinion about something.
Yep.
Regardless whether it's positive or not.
And now, then just the fun, like the jam session motivation of like me on Amazon rating Tuscan milk.
Now, there is also, of course, extrinsic motivations.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious one is money. Some of these people actually are paid. There are a lot of sites like, Amazon Mechanical Turk, for instance, that apparently pay.
Very low amounts of money.
Very little. And in fact, that brings up... Well, let's bracket that for a second, because that actually brings up an interesting ethical point.
Oh, yeah. I also wanted to talk about that. Good.
But let's go back to that in a minute. But there is still... That's an extrinsic motivation. I mean, however little you're being paid to do something. There's also a less tangible sort of extrinsic motivation, such as social recognition. right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you're not anonymous, obviously. But even if you are anonymous, there's sort of this you still have this feeling that you're recognized, if not you, your handle or whatever it is.
That's true, yeah. Right? That's
so
true.
There is a sense in which, okay, you do it because, in some sense, we're social animals. We'd like to be recognized by a social group, particularly a social group that we value for whatever reason. So, you know, the social group of people who contribute to a particular type of crowdsourcing problem, for instance, or open source software and that sort of stuff. So I think it's actually, as it turns out, I mean, I was wondering about motivations myself when I started reading about crowdsourcing, and it turns out actually that's probably one of the easiest thing to figure out, that there's plenty of motivations, both intrinsic and extrinsic, why people might want to do that, even anonymously. So it's now, shall we go back to the Mechanical Turk thing,
similar
because it's not the only one. I don't want to pick on Amazon in particular, and I don't know exactly how it works. I never participated to Mechanical Turk, but basically, people set up, the crowdsourcers set up a problem that can be, you know, either subdivided into different tasks, or people compete essentially a bid for doing a particular task. And then if they complete it within a certain period of time, then they get, monetary remuneration. Now, one of the problems with that, so clearly that gives, as we just said, an external motivation, extrinsic motivation. The problem is that it turns out that the statistics seems to be pretty clear that most of the time, the people who are paid to do these kinds of works are paid below minimum wage in the country from which they originate.
Wow, that's very low.
Right. And in fact...
Well, just because so many of them come from
India
or Indonesia.
Right, that's right. A large number come apparently from India, Indonesia, Bangladesh. But also the ones that come from the United States tend to be paid lower than minimum wage in the United States, which, of course, raises actually legal issues, particularly in countries where there is a minimum wage. But it also raises ethical issues. A lot of these projects, for instance, are done by researchers, by university researchers, who have grants that allow them to, you know, set up a project like this and get input from thousands or tens of thousands of people potentially. But the problem is that then in fact these projects are, for all effective purposes, exploiting other people's labor without recognition. So
yeah, I can just give an example of a project I know of that used Mechanical Turk. It was trying to train a machine learning, like an artificial intelligence algorithm, to be able to recognize. I think this is the project I'm thinking of, to recognize what was pornography and what wasn't. And so, you know, there are various, like,
I didn't know it was possible to do that.
And colors and, like, compositions of pictures that are more correlated with pornography than not. But you can't, it's hard to, like, give those instructions to a computer in a way that the computer could use to recognize pornography reliably.
That's
so,
right.
So what you have to do is just, you know, get a huge data set of things that are both porn and not porn, and get humans to go through and just click porn, not porn, porn, not porn. And gradually the computer can learn from their data what things are associated with, something being porn. So that would be a thing that Mechanical Turk would be used for. You just look at a picture, click porn or not porn, and you just do that for hours.
And you're paid for it.
And you're paid, yes. I suppose this wasn't the best example of unethical use of Mechanical Turk. But.
Well, it actually may be interesting, ethically even more interesting. But yeah, so okay, that sort of project does sort of raise these kinds of questions. There's another question which, again, especially for research projects, is brought up by crowdsourcing, which is the composition of the crowd itself.
Yeah.
Right. These are clearly not random samples of people. And in fact, there are some statistics, there are some studies on the demographics of crowdsourcing. And interestingly, the results of some of these studies, partly I would guess because the phenomenon is still new and therefore it's very dynamic, seem to be changing very rapidly. So for instance, there was a survey done in 2008 where the researchers found the majority of the contributors were Americans, young females, fairly well-educated and with fairly large incomes, rather large incomes. Hmm. But only a year later, another survey found a very different, this one focusing in particular on Mechanical Turk, found that actually two-thirds of, the majority of the about one third, I guess, 36% of the surveyed population was Indian, and that two thirds of these were male, and the level of education was slightly lower. The income was definitely lower And so there are differences in gender, there are differences in geographical distribution, there are differences in education. So especially, again, if you use this as a research project, then you might want to be cognizant of the fact that the kind of results you get might in fact depend, sometimes to a large extent, presumably, on the fact that you do not have a random sample of the population. And in some cases, you don't even know what your population is compared to what it should be. You know, you maybe want to target a particular, in the case of pornography, for instance. I would think that if you ask, if you present the same set of images to people with a fairly significantly different cultural background or even just gender biases, mm-hmm. you would get very different results in terms of final outcomes. So.
The study I was thinking of might just been, is there nudity or not? That might have been the question, not is it pornography? Because you're right, pornography is famously hard to define.
Yeah, well, nudity is probably easier, but still, even so, right? My guess would be the males would be more tolerant of nude images than females, especially in certain cultures. But in other cultures, it may go the other way around, or it may be that there are certain differences between, let's say, an American or Western audience versus Middle Eastern or Asian audience and so on. And we don't know at a time necessarily what these mm-hmm. are going to be, nor how you could possibly sort of counter that sort of sampling effect.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm a little confused about how to think about what harm is being done by offering people online from any country the ability to, or the opportunity to take on these tasks for very small amounts of money.
The obvious one is that this is a discussion we might not necessarily want to go into much
yeah.
detail, but it's the same kind of harm that you do anytime you manage to pay somebody less than the minimum wage,
yeah.
right? So,
all right, yeah, maybe we shouldn't
right.
actually.
So,
sorry,
so that becomes a political discussion,
thing.
but it's interesting because the listeners shouldn't get the idea that these are people who just necessarily do it for hobby. Because if you do something for a hobby and it's in your spare time, the fact that you get paid at all, it could be considered an additional incentive to do it, but it's not a major, it's not a big deal. But as it turns out, especially for some of the Indian workers that work on Amazon Mechanical Turk, that actually turns out to be a major component of their income. And either supplemental or, in fact, a large component of their income, in which case you really are talking about exploitation. Mm-hmm. So that sort of stuff.
I actually was thinking of another ethical issue with crowdsourcing that has occurred to me in the past. So competitions are a really good way for a company, organization, whatever, to generate really promising ideas for, I don't know, a plan for the park that they want to build or an idea for a logo or really anything. And this tactic is used a lot. And the reason that it's so effective is you as the company, the organization, gets dozens or hundreds or sometimes thousands of submissions. And all you have to do is pay for one of them. Maybe it's a large prize. But so it ends up being a really good deal for you. If you actually hired 1,000 people to each do a draft proposal for you and paid for their time, that would be incredibly expensive, far, far more than the amount of prize money you're giving out for the competition. And in some cases, I've seen, especially in architecture and design, the prize you get is just being hired. So you have thousands of people spending a lot of time creating submissions for the contest just for the chance of being hired. And I think that the reason that contests worked out to be such a good deal for the company sponsoring them is that people overestimate their likelihood of being chosen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I don't know that for sure. That's an empirical question, but that's my guess as to why they do it.
And yeah,
so it is kind of an exploitation of this cognitive bias that people have.
Although that's not different from the way we sell lottery tickets in some sense, right?
It's true. It's just sort of more
with the difference in the case of lottery tickets is entirely up to randomness.
I'm also not defending lottery tickets.
Right.
It's just a smaller. Well, I don't know. Maybe over the course of someone's life, it's a large expense they spend on lottery tickets. I was just thinking of in a contest, people spend a lot of time, and I used 99 designs to. Come up with the logo for my organization. And I felt pained at the hundreds of people who were submitting designs, almost all of whom
just
would
got a
not,
thank you note.
Not that.
Or did
I
even that? Oh, come on. You should have at least that. But it's not just companies. As it turns out, the interesting thing, if you look at the history of these things, again, pre-internet, It was governments largely that started this thing, particularly the French government.
Oh, really?
And to some extent the British government. So, you know, famous examples. So the French government throughout, for a couple of centuries actually, has done these national competitions to solve problems that up to that point were not resolved. So as it turns out, the first hydraulic commercial turbine was developed that way.
Really?
Through a competition of this kind. The French government also got somebody to develop a new way of preserving food in airtight containers.
Hmm.
And, of course, one of the most famous ones is the British government Longitude Prize.
Longitude Prize?
Yes. So this was a prize that was announced to determine the longitude of a ship at sea, which was an unsolved problem until fairly recently. And in fact, mm-hmm. there is an entire book called Longitude that is about the discovery of this method. And so that was, again, an interesting situation where it was actually governments, in this case French and the British government, that used the same system and successfully. And a lot of these prizes mm-hmm. actually did get, claimed. And society at large, you might say, benefited from this thing. But yes, probably there were a lot of unsent thank you notes
cool.
by both governments.
I kind of want to talk about the kinds of crowdsourcing problems where you're not just choosing, you know, your favorite option from among the many submissions, or you're not just hoping that one of the submissions turns out to work, but you're trying to sort of collectively reach truth, like trying to collectively generate the best answer. And I see huge differences between, say, Wikipedia on the one hand and Yahoo Answers on the other, both
yes.
of whom try to, you know, use this crowdsourcing approach to coming up with true answers to questions, but do dramatically different quality jobs at it. So, you know, Wikipedia on the one hand is, I've found, like, frequently more accurate than... Well, maybe not than like published books and journal articles, but certainly far more convenient and far more, I'd just say like far more accurate than like, I don't know, maybe reading like a pop science article. Maybe that's
possibly.
My benchmark.
There was this famous article a number of years ago now, of course, already in Nature magazine, that actually compared the accuracy of science entries, or certain kinds of science entries, between Wikipedia and the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oh, really?
And Wikipedia turned out to be about as accurate as Encyclopedia Britannica.
Wow, I didn't expect that.
Now, that's not true in general. Then you can't, for instance, as you know, there are certain areas of Wikipedia that are regularly disputed, especially when it comes down to political figures and topics, which is why, in fact, Wikipedia, contrary to what most people seem to think, it's not entirely a unstructured thing. I mean, they actually mm-hmm. do have filters, and they have people actually monitor certain contended pages and so on. Nonetheless, the result was interesting. In fact, as it turns out, on Wikipedia, you can look up the references about Wikipedia's accuracy. There is a page on Wikipedia about Wikipedia accuracy, and you don't need to trust that. You just need to go and check the original sources. Of course, the Encyclopedia Britannica, the editors of Encyclopedia Britannica, for instance, disputed the finding on the paper. And so the editors of Nature had to actually go back and check the data and adjudicate the dispute. And it turns out that the authors of the original paper were correct, that Wikipedia, for those entries in certain science topics, was in fact about as accurate as the Britannica. So
wow.
it's interesting.
Yeah, so
I think you're right, Yahoo Answers. The few times that I looked at some of the answers for those things, it were horrible.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
The classic Yahoo Answers question is, how is Babby formed?
Oh.
How is baby formed?
Yeah.
And the answers, you know, range from... You know what? I can't talk about it on the podcast. That just occurred to me. Never mind.
We don't have any kind of censorship, but okay, fine.
Point being, they were not accurate, and I would
not
want, you know,
right.
the you know children of our society being given sex ed by Yahoo Answers
right.
is my point here.
That's a bad idea.
Really
right.
what's relevant.
But for instance, here's another example that I use on a regular basis, which is whenever I have a computer problem, typically I don't look at manuals, first of all, at all, and I don't try, you know, the usual sort of, I don't know, customer support or something like that. I just Google the question. I phrase a question as in, you know, why does my iPad not do this?
Mm-hmm.
And typically, almost invariably, within the first page of answers, I will get to the right answer. And more often than not, the right answer comes out of a forum, of a user forum for that particular, you know, computer software or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And now there is quite a variety of quality of answers. Some of them are, in fact, most of them are actually useless, but you will get pretty quickly within the first page or two to something that you can actually use and solve the problem. Yeah. So again,
That's a nice example of a case in which you can recognize the true answer when you see it.
Yes.
Or you can find out whether it's likely to work. Whereas, you know, on Wikipedia or Yahoo Answers, a lot of the time you don't. The tricky problem really is in finding a way to let the correct answers rise to the top,
right,
because the reader is not able to tell which the correct answers are. I've only speculated, but I think it helps, of course, that Wikipedia has an active, you know, and smart moderating community. But it also helps, I think, that Wikipedia allows you to edit or delete, you know, submit for deletion other people's answers. Whereas on Yahoo Answers, you can submit your own, but you can't edit or delete other people's. And
right.
So you just end up with this huge proliferation of answers,
right,
most of which are horribly, amusingly wrong.
Right.
And that makes it harder to separate.
That brings me to another type of sort of crowdsourcing, which sometimes is referred to as crowd voting or crowd ranking.
Oh, yeah.
So this is used, obviously, by websites such as Google itself, but it's also used by increasingly by professional outlets. There is an increasing number of open source scientific journals that do that. So, for instance, the Public Library of Science, which is a collection of different kinds of journals that deal with biology, chemistry, physics, and so on, they essentially have abandoned the standard peer review process. They modified it. What they do is they still send out articles for review, but the reviewers are asked only to apply minimum standards. They're only asked to verify that the article is coherent, makes sense, that there's no obvious mistakes, nothing wrong with it. But they're not asked the other major thing that is usually a professional editor for a scientific journal does ask, which is, what is the worth of this paper
in
the field? Is it worth the space of publication, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
Now, since PLOS is online, they don't have a problem with space of publication, so they publish everything that meets these minimum standards of readability and coherence and, you know, sort of minimum standard of publishability. And then after that, it's the users of the site who have to be, I believe they have to be registered, so actually you know who they are. But, and presumably they're all professionals or, you know, members. They're not members of the public at large. But nonetheless, these are the users actually essentially get to vote on the papers, and papers that are read or commented more often get to the top of the list, and so they become more visible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an interesting system. It does save a lot of time. If you are somebody who wants to read the latest in this particular large field of science, then you're going to start with the articles that float to the top. Now, the problem is, of course, that there's several problems. One is that if the community is actually fairly small, you can have a random drift, essentially, things come floating up and down without necessarily having anything to do with the quality of the piece. And some scientific fields of research are, in fact, very small. The actual community is very small. Second, of course, the system is open to abuse from the outside, to trolling, essentially. I mean, you have to register to the website, but you can...
Is it trolling?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anybody can presumably register. And so you're going to... In fact, I'm going to give you an example in a minute of something that that may open even more so to outsiders essentially coming in and hijacking the system.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the other issue that... the judgment of even of a community of experts at a particular point in time may not be the best long-term judgment, and it tends to be self-reinforcing. You know, if one particular paper, you know, a group of papers floats to the top of the list, then obviously many more people will read those papers than anything else that is on the site, and they will tend to vote on a subset of the papers, which will sort of keep reinforcing the system, and then you might have some gems that are completely lost.
There was a great experiment, whose name I'm now blanking on, that took a large group of people, divided them up into several groups, and gave each group access to like a set of new songs, and they could download the songs and rate them and so on. And at the end of the period of time, whatever it was, the researchers looked at which songs were the most popular. And each group, there were a few songs that were the most popular by far. They were, you know, like the equivalent of the top 40, but in that, you know, small experimental group. Well, small, there are, I don't know, at least 10,000, I think. And
yeah, that's a small dish.
Yeah. I mean, small compared to the world. And but the most popular songs, the songs that were judged to be the best, were very different in each group. Right. And so the system of like judging the popularity of songs was just incredibly sensitive to initial conditions. So, you know, a few songs happened to get more, you know, positive votes early on, and then other people would listen to them and vote them positively, or rate them positively. And so there's just this snowball effect, and it right. sounds like, you know, a similar thing can happen with, you know, citing academic papers or...
Yeah. Or going back to Amazon reviews. I know that, unfortunately, because I think it's unethical, a number of publishers actually encourage their authors to rig up a bunch of friends once the book comes out and put out reviews. And, you know, that generates buzz. But you can argue that sort of that defeats, you know, it undermines the whole system.
Yeah. I think this this problem is a good example of one of the ways that the wisdom of crowds principle can fail.
The wisdom of crowd is one type of crowdsourcing, of course.
Right, right. The idea that the collective judgment of a crowd of people in aggregate results in more accurate decisions than, you know, than any single member of the group could have made or than an expert could have made. And, you know, classic examples of this are like if you get a group of people to try to estimate how many jelly beans are in a jar,
right.
The average of everyone's answers is going to be much more accurate than any individual person's answers or most
individual
people's answers.
Actually, the first recorded example of that, at least that I could find, it goes back to 1906. Mm-hmm. And it was a crowd that was asked, of 800 people, that was asked to estimate the weight of a slaughtered and dressed ox.
Oh,
and interestingly,
not as sweet as jelly beans.
That's right, it's not. But interestingly, first of all, they got it right within 1% of the true weight.
Wow.
And we're talking about more than 1,000 pounds, so it's a substantive amount of mass there. But interestingly, the person who actually carried the experiment, organized the experiment, was none other than Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin. And one of the early statisticians.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Cool.
So he was the first one to figure out that, maybe we can use these kind of things.
Yeah.
And, of course, the basic idea there, sort of from a statistical perspective, is that it works because the random errors that are going to be associated with any particular estimate are going to cancel each other.
The random errors, like the distance of that person's estimate from the true answer.
From the true answer. Yeah. Is going to be canceled especially if you get a sufficiently large crowd. In fact, there are people who have proposed theorems about the behavior of the error in crowdsourcing, that sort of stuff. So,
right.
But anyway, that was the first example. But you were saying...
I brought that up as sort of the classic example of the wisdom of crowds working. I mean, there are other examples, but this is one mm-hmm. classic example.
Right.
And as you were saying, one of the reasons this works is because the mistakes that people tend to make when estimating the number of jelly beans in a jar or the weight of an ox are sort of random and uncorrelated with each other. And
right.
So, you know, you have some people guessing too low and some people guessing too high, but you don't have, you know, most people systematically guessing high or most people systematically guessing low, which is why they average out to close to the true answer. So in cases when people are sort of systematically biased, the wisdom of crowds is not going to work for you. Like, you know, if you have people estimating which candidate is going to be the better president, even if we all agreed on what better president meant,
right.
There's still going to be systematic biases because everyone is, or most people are subject to, you know, thinking more highly of a candidate if he smiles more or is taller or has better marketing, you know? So these are going to like detract from the wisdom of crowds. And then the reason I brought this up was that another reason the wisdom of crowds doesn't work is if people hear each other's answers and
right.
are able to change their own opinion based on other people's answers. So you get this sort of echo chamber effect where, you know, I know that other people think this paper is good, so I'm going to take it more seriously, and then I'm going to say it's good, and other people will hear me say it's good, and so on.
Right.
And I've run into this problem personally, and I've had to be, like, train myself to be more personally mindful of this non-independence of opinions problem. So, for example, when I first moved out to the Bay Area, I noticed that I met a lot of really smart, well-educated people who seemed quite
Beware
confident.
Beware of those.
I know. I try to avoid them. So a lot of smart, educated people who thought that the paleo diet was the sort of best nutritional choice you could make for yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the diet where you you try to eat as closely as possible to what our ancestors ate in, you know,
the
Pleistocene.
Yeah.
So, you know, meat and vegetables and, you know, some fruits, no processed food or grains, and there's like people go back and forth on dairy.
Where do they get their mammoth meat?
That's... Well, so, you know, as close as possible. Oh, there's some wiggle room there.
Right, right.
But anyway, so I was pretty struck by this at first. Like, wow, all of these people, you know, have come to the conclusion that paleo diet is the way to go. And then I started digging a little deeper and asking them, so, you know, how did you come to this conclusion? You know, so I asked John, and John was like, well, you know, I know this guy, Will, has done a lot of research on the paleo diet, and, you know, he's really smart, and, you know, I trust him. And then I asked, you know, Mary, and she's like, well, I know a lot of people really buy into it, and I, you know, Will has done a lot of research on it. Then I asked, you know, Max, and he was like, well, I talked to Mary, and she, you know, was really, and so on. And so, you know, you can, like, chart all of the causes of people's belief in the paleo diet, and they mostly boil down to, like, this one guy doing research on it, and then other people listening to him, and listening to other people who listen to him. Yeah. And it's not just equivalent to one person's opinion, because there's some additional evidentiary weight added by the fact that all these other people trusted his judgment enough to adopt his belief. But it's still, it's far less than, you know, whatever 12 independent conclusions would be.
What you're going to end up having in that case is a violation of the principle of independence of the errors.
Right, that's where I'm going.
So you have obviously data points that tend to be biased in a particular direction. Now, that direction may be correct if the initial bias was in fact correct, if the initial estimate was correct, but there's definitely, you lose what is supposed to be the advantage of the crowdsourcing to begin, or the
right, you
the
lose the,
to begin with.
Like the connection between the number of people in your sample and the confidence that you can have in, you know, their consensus, right. That connection is severed if those people are not giving their independent opinions.
Right. Now, we should also make clear that when people talk about wisdom of the crowd, so the first time, let me back up for a second here, the first time I heard the term wisdom of the crowd, I thought, oh, here we go, another New Age mystic bumbo jumbo thing. It's like, yeah. What do you mean wisdom of the crowd? But it, you know, as we know, it does work. There's pretty good empirical evidence of the cases in which it does work and in the cases in which it doesn't work, as the one that you just mentioned. But the crowd doesn't necessarily mean, certainly doesn't mean a random sample, as we were sharing earlier with other examples, but it also doesn't necessarily mean a crowd of non-experts, because sometimes it's presented that way, the phenomenon is presented that way. Oh, you know, it's a bunch of people know
well,
better than the experts.
Especially striking that way.
Right. Yeah. When it does happen, it's very striking. But in fact, a lot of the times, the crowd itself is in fact a crowd of experts. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that participate to the crowdsourcing situation or experiment is in fact experts made up of experts, either on purpose, either because it's designed that way, because, you know, particular community is because the crowdsourcing is limited to a particular community, or sort of more or less automatically, right? So if I'm sure that if we crowdsource, for instance, you know, solutions for Matt's last theorem, we'll probably get an overwhelming majority of mathematicians, because most other people wouldn't even know what Fermat's last theorem is or where to even begin to propose a solution for the theorem. And so you automatically have a sort of a selection toward experts. That doesn't mean that all the entire crowd or even the majority of the crowd would be made of, you know, let's say top mathematicians, for instance, but it certainly would be made of people who know enough about mathematics to even understand what the question is and sort of try to make a contribution.
Right. So that's the selection bias or the selection effect working, I guess, towards your advantage if your goal is to get the right answer, can also totally work against you,
correct.
Which is actually another thing that I've, you know, trained myself or tried to train myself to be more mindful of. I think I might have given this example in some podcast earlier, but in case I didn't or in case people forgot, when I was thinking of applying to grad schools back when I was in college, I asked a bunch of professors if they enjoyed academia, if they enjoyed being professors. And they were generally very positive and encouraging, which I took to be a great sign. And then only later did it occur to me that I had only been asking the opinions of people who liked academia enough to pursue it and stick with it. The people who knew ahead of time that they wouldn't like academia or who tried it and realized they hated it were not in my sample of people I was talking to. So
that's like asking Plato what's the best profession that one could have in life, and the answer of course is philosopher.
Right. Or who should be in charge of countries? philosophers, philosopher kings.
Now there's one more thing before we're moving toward wrapping up already at this topic, but there's another issue here that sort of came out in my reading. It's interesting. It's sometimes referred to as the crowd within.
The crowd within. That also sounds New Agey.
It does sound New Agey, doesn't it? But this is basically the idea that the individual cognition also has a probabilistic component to it, mm-hmm. and therefore it has sort of again these errors that cause this distance between the estimate and the true response that you're looking for, and therefore by sampling the individual himself or herself multiple times, you actually reduce the errors.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is cool, and it actually does seem to work.
Ooh, so in what context has it been
tried?
Well, there's
some research that shows this for instance, if you ask the same question to somebody over a period of time, if you ask two or three times the same question, and you get different estimates as an answer, the average of those estimates actually is in fact statistically significantly better than in each one of the point estimates. However, the interesting thing is that there seems to be some limitations. First of all, apparently it does depend on your memory, on the subject's memory. That is, the people with better memory.
Yes, then it doesn't work as well.
Memory don't work as well.
Yeah, because they're not independent.
That's right. They're not independent. And apparently, also the idea is that you don't want to do it over too long of, too many times. There seems to be an optimal level of what they call, sometimes it's referred to as dialectical bootstrapping, which is a fancy term for just saying. What you can do is you can get a first estimate, and then you can ask the person in question to entertain a counter opinion about the estimate that he has just given. And the research seems to show that if you do ask people to entertain counter opinions, they do come up with a better estimate overall.
That I have heard,
Time. Yeah. So it's cool. There's all sorts of interesting. Now this research is not entirely sort of clear-cut. There are other papers that seems to show that the effect is either not as strong as some other people claim, or, as I said, that there are some other circumstances needs to be taken into account, including the memory of the individual. But still, it's an interesting concept that you could sample yourself over time and come up with a better average than if you ask yourself the question only once.
Very cool. Well, it looks like we are now out of time, so let's wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the Rationally Speaking picks. I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that if you're a fan of the Rationally Speaking podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this year's Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which will be held in New York, New York, the weekend of April 5th through 7th, 2013. Go to nexus.org now to get your tickets. They're on sale. In addition to Massimo and I, you'll also find a lineup of great speakers, including the SGU, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, and our keynote speaker, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Drunkard's Walk. Nexus.org, that's NECSS.org. Go get your tickets now.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Well, Massimo, my pick is a book by Nate Silver you've probably heard of.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of the guy.
Called The Signal and the Noise. I'm in the middle of it right now. Of course it had to be a pick. It was just a question of when. So it's my pick now. And it is as good as people say it is. Nate Silver is, I'm just so delighted with him. Like, it's like hearing my own thoughts, spoken by someone, you know, even more eloquently than I could. It just like warms my heart.
You want to remind the two or three people who don't know who he is?
Yeah. So, you know, Nate Silver, predicted the 2008 election within a hair's breadth. And also essentially perfectly predicted the outcome of the 2012 election as well. Yeah.
Not only the election itself, but actually state by state.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that's what I mean, state by state. Not just yes or no, which would not be as impressive.
No.
but state by state, yeah. Just far more accurate than almost any other pundit or pollster. And he uses, you know, really solid statistics. And he talks in his book about the methods he uses for making predictions and about why they work and why other sort of common methods of making predictions don't work. And the thing that I personally really like about the book is the shout outs that he gives to Bayes' rule and Bayesian inference, which is basically a philosophy of statistics or a way of doing statistical inference that I think is basically correct, but it's not in as wide use as I wish it were. And this one passage in the book on, I think, page 331, he describes essentially a game that people could play that I now really want to play. That would be like a game to train people to make predictions like rational Bayesian agents. So let me find the description. Yeah, so the event would involve people going around at this party or whatever, carrying signs showing the odds that they assign to various outcomes, like the stock market crashing in the next month, or life being discovered on Mars, or so-and-so being crowned the next American Idol, whatever. And as people mingle, when they pass each other and they see on each other's, signs that they've assigned different odds to the same outcome, they are obliged to discuss and either come to a consensus, share their evidence and come to a consensus and revise their odds to be the same, or they have to place a bet on their respective forecasts. If I think that you're wrong, then I should be willing to wager some amount of money. Right. As they say, a bet is a tax on bullshit.
So my pick is an app for the iPhone and iPad that was released pretty recently. It's called Phi2Phi, P-H-I 2 as in the number, P-H-I. And in fact, I've actually written about it for the Rationally Speaking blog. It's put out by Jonathan Weisberg, who is a philosopher. And this is of interest to either professional philosophers, graduate students, or just people who want to play little philosopher. Mm-hmm. And basically what it is you open the app and you have a list of questions that other people have asked, other users have asked. And the questions are organized by branch of philosophy. So there's questions about epistemology, ethics, general questions in philosophy, history of philosophy, and so on and so forth. And then what you can do is you can answer the questions, or in any question. As soon as you answer the question, the system, the app gives you the current status of the answers from the crowd. We just talked about who's the one, the crowd. Mm-hmm. As far as that particular answer is concerned. The more time passes, the more the answers are updated, and so you can see what happens over time. The whole thing is anonymous, so nobody knows who is actually putting out the answers. And then you can ask your own questions, if you will. So I tried both. I answered a few questions and to see what happened, and then I asked my own. And so I give you a couple of examples. One of the questions that I answered was concerned Star Trek teletransporting devices.
So,
what happens when Kirk is about to be teleported into another place? And the answers that were available are, A, Kirk dies, a Trekkie cries, or B, Kirk is Kirk 1 or Kirk 2, mm-hmm. whichever you like, or C, Kirk is, parentheses, Kirk 1 and Kirk 2 before and after teleportation. So there's a potential Kirk, and then there's an actual Kirk. Mm-hmm. Or D, Kirk is Kirk 1 and Kirk 2, but only after transport. Mm-hmm. Or E, Kirk is Kirk 1 and Kirk is Kirk 2, adios transitivity of identity. And so on. There's another two or three. And the interesting thing is that you can look at the responses, and so and the raw responses, that is, the responses by anybody who has answered the question, at the moment, as I'm looking at the graph, give A as winning, which is Kirk dies, a Trekkie cries. Okay, so you better not step into the teleporter if you...
You biased them, though, because, research has shown that people trust statements more when they rhyme.
Aha! I didn't actually prepare this particular question. Somebody else did. But that was now the other interesting thing is you can do. You can filter the answers if there is enough of them by the person's background and or discipline. So you're supposed to, as a user, you're supposed to put in information about who you are. And so if you filter, for instance, this question by philosophers, people who have either a degree or have a professional career in philosophy, then actually answer A, Kirk dies, goes up even more clearly. And you can filter further, not only among philosophers, but metaphysicians. And it turns out that the overwhelming majority of metaphysicians who answered this particular question, in fact, again, agree that, yes, Kirk, in fact, does die. So it's kind of interesting. One of my questions that I've asked, the question of the relationship between logic and mathematics. And so the way I put the question was, what is the relationship between logic and mathematics? Mm-hmm. And I gave the following five possible answers to users. Math is a branch of logic, mm-hmm. or logic is a branch of math, or they are related but distinct types of deductive reasoning, or it depends on what you mean by logic, or other, and users can add their own answers. And so far at the moment, as we're looking at it, the responses are still small in number so much that I can't really do any filtering. But so far, apparently, C is the winner. They are related but distinct types of deductive reasoning. So, yeah, it's fun. I highly recommend it. Phi2Phi is the name of the app. Jonathan Weisberg is the producer, philosopher.
Cool, and what an appropriate pick for our crowdsourcing episode.
Exactly.
Well, this concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the border between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.